are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Someone you know of or even love is the person who will kill you. Usually that's true, but that is not what happened in 2018 to two college students in Iowa. Two young women who had everything to live for, killed by two men with nothing to lose. Completely random attacks. Neither case had anything else in common except they both shocked the nation and even the world. What's worse, being murdered by a loved one or a stranger who jumps out of the bushes when you are most vulnerable? Previously published as We'll Find You and Let's Do Murder, The Iowa Murders tells the shocking true crime stories of the senseless deaths of Molly Tibbetts and Celia Barquin Arozamena. When Molly Tibbetts disappeared on July 18, 2018, her mother, Laura Calderwood, promised she would never quit searching. For 5 weeks in the summer of 2018, she searched and the whole world watched Brooklyn, Iowa, because this was more than a murder story. It also became one of the top political stories of 2018. Then, just after her killer led police to Molly's body, hidden in a cornfield, news of another shocking, senseless homicide came from Iowa. Celia Barquin Arozamena was ready to begin the next phase of her life, including a professional career and marriage. Colin Richards only wanted a woman to rape and murder. Celia had everything to live for, and Colin had nothing to lose. They would come together one day in September 2018. Only one would survive. This is the shocking true crime story of two communities and two families coming to grips with the worst crime imaginable, knowing that even if the killer's put behind bars today, another could be waiting tomorrow. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Iowa Murders, a shocking true crime story, with my special guest, journalist and author, Rod Cackley. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Rod Cackley.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for this. Congratulations on this new release. Let's get right to July 17, 2008, and tell us a little bit about the small place, Brooklyn, Iowa, and a little bit about this Molly Tibbetts, and she's on her very regular run in the evening. So tell us a little bit about Brooklyn, Iowa, and Molly Tibbetts.
Brooklyn, Iowa, Dan, is a town of about 1,500. I mean, this is small-town America. And Molly sets her earbuds in place. She's going out for an evening run through the streets of Brooklyn. Now, she does it every night. Even though she's not native to Brooklyn, Iowa, everyone in town knows her. They're used to watching her run by in the evening. She's so familiar that people mowing their lawns or relaxing on their porches will wave to her as she goes by their houses. And really, that's the kind of town that Brooklyn is, where they're so friendly, they would just wave to someone who may be a stranger to them.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about her living arrangements and her friend, boyfriend, Dalton Jack. She's a psychology major at the University of Iowa. Tell us the living arrangements and where her boyfriend and her brother are at the time when she goes for this run.
Yeah, you're right, Dan. As you said, Molly Tibbetts is a psychology major at the University of Iowa. She and her boyfriend, Dalton Jack, are living with his brother. Now, both of them are out of town at the time. They're on a construction project in another town in Iowa. So Molly is at home alone pretty much now. And, you know, this is a time where this is a summer off from the University of Iowa. And she's young, this is freedom, she's, you know, living on her own. setting up housekeeping with her boyfriend, Dalton, the guy she loves, plans to marry. And so this is a big time for her. This is a time of real, young freedom, I guess is a way to put it.
Mm-hmm. She's also working in the summer at a children's day camp at a regional medical center, and the kids love her, and she loves her job. Everyone thinks she's great. And she's also, when she's running, she uses this Fitbit activity tracker, and she's got her smartphone with her on that run. So tell us about a little bit about this run that she does. Usually goes around the same route. You say that people in this small community know who she is. They're very familiar with her. She's out on this run July 17, 2008. What happens on this normally mundane or routine run of Molly's?
Well, as you said, Dan, she's carrying a Fitbit activity tracker and a smartphone. That's very important to remember. As she's going on her usual run, all of a sudden a car... one of the neighbors, Devin Riley, sees her runs by his house. He's on his porch, and he waves hello to her like he does almost every night. Well, he doesn't see anything unusual, but Molly does. Suddenly, there's a car behind her. Now, it's not that unusual to see somebody on the road at this time of the night, but this guy just doesn't give up. You know, she'll slow down, expecting him to pass her. He doesn't pass her. He slows down. She runs faster, thinking she can get away from him. He drives faster. So obviously, he's following her. It's a black car, a car that she does not recognize. When she turns, she decides to turn right, then left. He follows her. When she stops running, he stops driving. Now she's very worried. She's concentrating on the run. She's a good runner. She's a practiced runner. She's a trained runner. So the fact that she's running, you know, she figures she can outrun this guy if nothing else. She looks back, and the car passes her, finally. Finally, the car passes her. So Molly figures everything's okay. She was mistaken to be worried. But her relief only lasts moments. The car circles the block, and all of a sudden, it's back behind her again. Finally, she decides to stop and confront the guy. She is not going to put up with this. And that is, in an instant, she realizes that she was wrong to do that. She hears a car door close. She doesn't look back. She knows it's trouble. Quickly, she's running as fast as she can. She's forgotten about confronting the guy. She just takes off. She looks back over her shoulder. She's running even faster. Can't believe what he sees. The guy's out of his car, and now he's running after her. She figures that she can outrun him, perhaps even outfight him. But she grabs her smartphone and practically shoves it into the guy's face. He's not a big guy, a couple inches taller than Molly, about 5'6", thick black hair, neatly trimmed mustache and goatee. He grabs her smartphone as she shoves it into his face. They're running side by side now, matching her pace step for step. She yells, "I'm going to call the police," waving the phone at him. He doesn't back off. You think he might, but he doesn't. And now it's a real fight. Now this guy is fighting her. She's never been in a real fight before. And, you know, as I wrote, in the blink of her eyes and the state of his and the stare of his, she sees the end of her life.
Yeah. You write then the next thing, July 19th, Molly doesn't show up for work at this medical center. And, of course, this is unlike her. And Dalton, her boyfriend, had texted her that morning, and there was no response. So he calls her mother, Laura Calderwood. So what happens, Dalton and Molly and the search for her that morning?
Well, he's worried immediately. You know, they're young and in love, so they're used to texting each other back and forth, "Good morning, I love you," that kind of thing. He does that. She does not respond as she does every day. So now he's worried. He doesn't hear from her. He tries her again and again. Then he calls her mother, Laura. Laura's worried, too. But she's thinking, hey, Brooklyn's too small to, you know, she calls Molly. She's afraid something's wrong. Then work, the day camp center calls Dalton and her. Laura calls the center. All of a sudden, she knows something's wrong. She's a mother. Laura can just feel it. Something is definitely wrong. Brooklyn doesn't have its own police department. The Poweshiek County Sheriff's Office handles law enforcement in Brooklyn, Iowa. So Laura calls the sheriff's department, but before she goes to bed that night, she sends a text to Molly's phone. She texts, "I love you. We're looking for you. We'll find you no matter what." And she tries to go to sleep.
Yeah.
They begin searching for her immediately. And then about 10 days later, in Kearney, Missouri, police get a tip. You know, the word goes out. It's a small town. So, you know, the next morning, everyone knows that Molly's missing. Everybody's involved in the search, and they're all volunteering to help.
But you have the Iowa Department of Criminal Investigation and the FBI involved because of this, what they determine early on as an abduction, don't they?
Correct. Yeah, they're correct. They're assuming that it's an abduction. They don't really have any eyewitnesses, but just everything is, they're checking surveillance video from gas stations and convenience stores at points where the kidnapper might have stopped before racing out of town. They're assuming that she's been kidnapped. They get a tip that she was seen at a gas station that turns out in Kearney, Missouri, about 230 miles away from Brooklyn. That turns out to be a false alarm. Then they go to a hog farmer's house in Guernsey, asking to search the property without a warrant. Why that farm? Well, Molly was last seen jogging within a 15-minute drive of the property. Remember, they can track her cell phone or smartphone, and they can track that Fitbit tracker. So they have an idea of where she is. So now they're talking to this farmer, Wayne Cheney. Says he doesn't have anything to hide. He lets the FBI spend a couple of hours inside his house and garage taking photos. The investigative team asks Wayne to go to the local firehouse with them for an interview. He does this without a lawyer, and they spend 2 hours together talking. Wayne tells them, like everybody else, he's heard about Molly's disappearance, but he's never met her, doesn't know who she is. After this interview, he allows them to keep his cell phone overnight so that they can check his phone records. Wayne comes out of this and talks to a reporter and says he thought it was all a waste of time, but oh well. After they finish searching the farm, the FBI spends more time walking through about a mile of ditches near the farm. Do they have so much interest in the land and the farmers simply because of the location? But no, there's more. There's a potential clue. They find a red shirt, not unlike the shirts Molly and the other people who work at that day camp wear every day. The shirt was discovered by a guy mowing his lawn near the Lincoln Wildlife Reserve. So he calls sheriff's deputies. And it turns out that Wayne Cheney, even though this had nothing to do with Molly, Wayne Cheney pled guilty to stalking charges twice in 2009 and 2014. And so they've got a real interest in Wayne Cheney at this point and in Wayne's farms.
Mm-hmm. However, they don't find any information or evidence in that extensive search, and he's cooperative. And there are other people that they looked at. However, what they still were looking at was trying to get video surveillance from the businesses, local businesses, but also other homes. So while they were doing their regular routine investigation, they were still analyzing some of those and also putting out information to the public for leads in this case as well, didn't they?
Right, exactly. And, you know, the whole community started searching. 400 spontaneously started searching the day after Molly went missing. But the county sheriff's office says everybody stand down. If they're needed, the word will go out. It's hard to coordinate 400 people. And when the police aren't in charge of it, who knows what they're going to do, what evidence they might contaminate, for instance, what crime scene they might contaminate. So they tell people who are searching to just go home, stand down. If we need you, we'll put the word out on social media. So what they do then is, speaking of social media, they're honing in on Molly's digital footprint. Dozens of search warrants are filed to gain access to Molly's social media accounts, along with devices like that smartphone and the Fitbit. And that opens the door to a ton of information. It's amazing how they can track you and how they tracked Molly and her movements on that with that smartphone and the Fitbit.
Yeah, it's interesting. You write that via the GPS, they could see exactly her running, and then traveling later in a vehicle because they could make no other conclusion other than that she was moving so fast. So almost in four of these people was the evidence, more than a very strong circumstantial evidence, that this is what happened to her and that she was certainly abducted and taken in a car.
Exactly. Right, right. Yeah, that first chapter where I describe her run, that really is taken from her the GPS information. That's what the GPS tracker shows happen. The running, the starting, the stopping, the turning left, the turning right, that kind of thing. And then what they do is they get on Facebook, Twitter, and other social media to figure out the kind of person that Molly is, or the person that she was, I guess you should say. And they're surprised to see nothing but positive statements about Molly. You know, there are haters on Facebook, but nobody hates Molly. Everybody loves this woman. So that brings a whole other thing into this, where they're starting to figure out her personality. Then they want to find out who she's been chatting with recently, what they talked about, if there's anything that's relevant to the investigation. The team believes right now that Molly is alive. They're holding out hope, and they really believe that she's alive, the investigative team, I mean to say. They do think she was abducted, but they believe at this point she is alive. However, people who know her, the people who know Molly, tell the police they cannot believe that Molly was taken without a fight. They really believe that Molly... Now, Molly is something of an athlete, too, okay? And she may never have been in a real fight, but she is a strong, athletic woman, and they can't believe that anyone would take her away if she was still alive.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. You talked about everybody that knows her thought that a stranger couldn't trick her or overpower because she was a person that was in great shape. And you also talk about Rob Tibbetts, her father. Again, they go to the national media and ABC's Good Morning America, and he just wants to focus on bringing her back. As you say, everyone wants to hope and believe that she is still alive, and a reward, you say, goes up from $170,000 to $260,000, and flyers at baseball games. So there's an incredible effort in the community by Rob Tibbetts and others and friends to be able to let people know about this search for this woman.
And, yeah, and you know, now the family, I'm sorry, the family dynamic here, too, is really interesting, Dan. Rob Tibbetts lives in San Francisco. He and Laura Calderwood are divorced. So here you have the ex-husband flying into Brooklyn, Iowa, to take part in this. And I thought that was just a really interesting part of the story.
Absolutely. Now, you talk about August 20th. So not too far along, but police get a home surveillance video from someone from a house on July 18th. Now, what do they see in this video, and what do they conclude?
Yeah, this was a real break. A month and 2 days after Molly vanished, after tracking down thousands of leads and citizen tips, they finally get a videotape that could crack the case wide open. It's a home surveillance video. It shows Molly running by a home on July 18th. On the tape, they can see a black Chevy Malibu that seems to be following Molly, speeding up and slowing down as she does, and finally stopping, just like the GPS info had told them. Now, if this isn't the person who kidnapped Molly, they figure he's at least, or this person, he or she is at least one of the last people to ever see Molly alive. And so they have to find this car. The description of the Malibu goes out to every police official in Iowa. Every set of law enforcement eyes is looking for this black Malibu that the FBI is afraid carried Molly to her final resting place.
Mm-hmm.
A county deputy finds the car. I'm sorry, go ahead, Dan.
No, I was going to ask. You talk about a deputy being alert and spotting the car. What happens?
Yeah, right, right. On the road, a county deputy spots the car and pulls it over, walks up very slowly to the side of the car, and approaches the driver's window. It's a man alone in the Chevy Malibu, and there he meets Christian Vahina Rivera. Computer check shows the 25-year-old has no history of any criminal conduct with any police department in the area. Rivera's been working at a local dairy farm for about 4 years, but this is interesting. He's been working at the dairy farm under a different name, the name of John Budd. Now, Rivera can't produce any identification under either name, John Budd or Christian Vahina Rivera. Here's another point. Very difficult conversation between the deputy and Rivera because neither right. is fluent in the other's language.
Mm-hmm.
Rivera is a native of Mexico. He answers some questions, and they are able to put a few things together, he and the deputy.
Now, you say that they have the problem of getting a translator. So they find a person mm-hmm. named, an officer, Iowa City police officer named Pamela Romero, and she's fluent in Spanish. Tell us what happens once she gets involved.
Well, she makes a real connection with Rivera. He opens right up to her. It's not just that they're fluent in Spanish together. He just seems very comfortable with Pamela. You know, they just open up, and he starts talking tells the whole story. Not the story about Molly, but he just is comfortable. He gives a DNA sample with no problem at all. He agrees to let the officer search inside the car, his car, the Malibu. And the officers find a blood stain in the trunk, or at least it looks like a blood stain in the trunk. They've got to get that to the mm-hmm. forensic lab, of course. That's enough, they figure, to bring Rivera into headquarters for more questioning. He's told he can ride with a city police car and be brought back to his Malibu when they're finished. Officer Romero, Pamela Romero, asks in Spanish if he'll go with the feds and the Iowa City cops. Rivera agrees, and so then they get him in for questioning. They've been talking to him so far for about 90 minutes. The interview really begins now. It's 5:05 in the evening. They take 10 breaks, but other than that, nonstop questioning, just Officer Pam Romero and Rivera until about 11:30 at night. So you're looking at 6.5 hours of interrogation. And then, and only then, is Rivera read his Miranda rights.
Mm-hmm. You say that they believe he's implicated himself in her murder, and the only question left is, where's her body?
Right. That is the only question left. Where is the body? And so on August 21, 2018, Rivera, you know, they ask him what happened, you know, and he's really struggling to tell the story of his encounter with Molly. He says she tried to run away but couldn't. He talks about the fight they had on, you know, for the cell phone, the smartphone. And then he says, the next thing I remember is taking her body out of the trunk. I saw blood on the side of her head. Then he talks about putting her body into a cornfield and covering it up with corn stalks to protect her from the sun.
Yeah. So he also talks about this, again, very convenient that he got mad when she pulled out the phone, and then but he says, when I get upset, I block my memory, or mm-hmm. again, I guess he meant his memory is blocked, he can't remember, but of course then the next thing he does remember is taking her body out of the trunk, and he saw the blood
right.
on the side of her head.
Yeah, yeah, and taking, then he takes the police to where he left the body to, so.
Mm-hmm. So they find this body, it's many days decomposed. What else do they find forensically in terms of what has happened to her, stab wound wise and otherwise?
Oh yeah, it was a vicious stabbing attack. Stabbed in the head, stabbed multiple times. They find her clothing had been ripped off of her and left in the area. Yeah, it's a very bloody, bloody crime scene.
Yeah, you say that she into her chest numerous times and even broke through her skull. There was evidence
right.
of a violent struggle, defense wounds on her hands, and she didn't die quickly, right, whatsoever.
Right, right, exactly.
Now, he has a $1 million bond, so he's not going anywhere. And after this, reward had got up to $400,000 and 1,500 tips. They finally have this perpetrator behind bars, but now this case, again, the particulars of the case are interesting enough for national and international media, But now, because they find out the immigration status of this person, what does this story become?
Now it becomes a political story. Now former President Donald Trump tells an audience at a rally in Charleston, West Virginia, you heard about today the illegal alien coming in very sadly from Mexico, and you saw what happened to that incredible, beautiful young woman. Should not have happened illegally in our country, Trump says. We've had a huge impact, but the laws are so bad. The immigration laws are such a disgrace. We're getting it changed, but we have to get more Republicans. So this becomes a very political. Now, remember, this is, we're talking the off-term election here. This is 2018. This is a midterm election, I guess I should say. And so this becomes a very big political story.
It's interesting, too. It's surprising that the farm where he worked, they asked, and again, they got numerous hundreds of threatening calls. Why did they get threats against them? And what was the defense of the owner of that farm in regards to hiring this illegal immigrant?
Yeah, this is Yarrabee Farms near Brooklyn, Iowa. And they are totally taken by surprise. They said that they did their best. They received close to 100 threatening phone calls as of 10 o'clock in the morning, August 22nd. So this is really blowing up. The people, death threats, what have you. And the question is, if Rivera was in the country illegally, how did he gain employment at Yarrabee? And Dan Yarrabee claims the staff did everything required by the federal and state laws to ensure that Rivera was in the U.S. legally. They had no idea, they claim, that he was here illegally. And they just found out in the past 24 hours, they say, that the name John Budd that he gave them was a fake name. They said it's really the federal and state bureaucracies that fell down on the job here.
Yeah. You talk about August 22nd, the first court appearance, and in this small town, Christine's girlfriend, Iris Moneras, also went to school with Molly, so a small town. But another person, Bailey Gibson, comes forward to say that he followed her sister in the same way, using the same, and when she heard the report, it struck a nerve in her to say that we're very similar. And August 23rd is the funeral from Molly. Tell us a little bit about
right.
that.
The funeral, it doesn't matter if they're Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Muslim, or atheist at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Brooklyn. Everyone's welcome, but especially true this evening, August 23rd, for the funeral of Molly. Father Corey Close calls her a beautiful young woman, but he notes evil is irrational, so we can never wrap our minds around it fully. Others in Brooklyn are shocked for a different reason. Chloe Redding says it's terrible to see the suspected killer on TV and realize that she was friends with him on Facebook. So you talk about that small town. So many people in this town knew both of these people, Rivera and Molly.
Yes. While he's awaiting court, let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is EveryPlate. EveryPlate makes home cooking easy and affordable as a much cheaper alternative to takeout, but just as delicious. Think of it this way. One meal from EveryPlate is the same price as one cup of coffee. Recipes come together in about 30 minutes, definitely faster than a trip to the grocery store and starting a meal from scratch. EveryPlate offers a changing menu of 14 recipes per week, featuring a range of flavors and ingredients so you'll never get bored. I got the ginger chicken with bell peppers recipe. That was my favorite. Delicious and huge portions of high-quality cuts of meat and fresh vegetables. It saved me a lot of time for my wife and I, Lisa, for not having to go to the grocery store. It had quality ingredients, great recipes, and delicious food. At first, I was skeptical, thinking meal kits might be expensive, but now I'm convinced you can get the same delicious food at a much lower price. Get started with EveryPlate for just $1.99 per meal by going to EveryPlate.com and entering code TRUEMURDER199. That's get started with EveryPlate for just $1.99 per meal by going to everyplate.com and entering code TRUEMURDER199. Now, we were talking about him getting ready, Christiane getting ready, and his defense attorneys getting ready for this trial. And then on September 17th, 2018, we're talking about a few weeks later, Celia Barquin Arozamena is playing golf by herself at the Coldwater Golf Links in Ames, Iowa. This is a public course. Tell us who this Celia Arozamena is, and a little bit more about her life, and a little bit about more about this golf plan that she has planned for golf that day.
Okay, quite simply, Celia is one of the best women amateur golfers in the world at this point. Earlier this year, or that year, the 22-year-old won the European Links Amateur Championship with a course record 63. She qualified for the 2018 U.S. Women's Open before missing the cut. She captured the 2018 Big 12 individual title and was honored as Iowa State's Female Athlete of the Year. She comes from Spain, a town of 15,000 in Spain, Fuente San Miguel, Spain. She has outplayed her eligibility at Iowa State University. Remember, Molly went to the University of Iowa. Now, Celia is working on her degree at Iowa State University. She's no longer eligible to play on the university's team, but she is still obviously a very talented amateur golfer. Shoulder-length blonde hair, blue eyes, bright, infectious smile, bubbly personality. She's half a world away from her family in Spain, but her mother has always said that Celia is delighted with her life in Iowa. Now, this morning, she's alone. She's on the fourth tee at Coldwater, which is one of the best public courses in the state of Iowa.
And so what happens to alert people that something has gone wrong? You talk about four guys that were let her go ahead, realizing that she was going to get through the course much quicker than them, and then they find some evidence that something has gone awry.
Yeah, it's four middle-aged guys, and they know that Celia is going to play a lot faster than them, so they allow her to play it through. An hour later, one of the guys is Harley Thornton. We call him the leader of this foursome here. The Harley's foursome arrives at the ninth tee, and they can see that something's wrong. Celia's golf bag, several tees, her rangefinder, and her hat are all lying on the ground. But there's no sign of Celia. I mean, that's not something you see on the golf course. Nobody abandons their clubs in the middle of the fairway, ever. And there's one more sign of trouble, Celia's cell phone. Harley finds it on the ground, too. Now, they haven't heard any sounds that would suggest Celia was in danger. No screams, no sounds of a struggle, no signs of a struggle except this stuff left on the course. But shortly after 10 a.m., Harley calls Coldwater's Pro Shop to report what they have found, and then he calls 911. And minutes later, the Ames Police Department receives a corresponding call from a 911 dispatcher notifying them of Harley's concern. So the police arrive at Coldwater at 10:24, about 24 minutes after Harley's foursome found what they found on the ninth tee.
You talk about this Mitch Mortvedt is on the case, and he's the assistant director of the Iowa Department of Criminal Investigation. How is it that a police officer in Ames, Heath Ropp, spots Dalton Barnes? Who's Dalton Barnes, and why does he stop him, and what does he have to say?
Okay, we should backtrack a little bit to the golf course, and they did find her body. Another group of golfers found Celia's body on the course in a pond. Now, Heath Ropp spots Dalton Barnes. Dalton Barnes is a 22-year-old who's one of these guys who has just never made it in life. He got out of the state prison June 4th of this year after serving about 7 months for violating terms of a probation that he'd been sentenced to for conviction and burglary and some other related crimes. He's been troubled his whole life. He's living homeless, living in a tent in an area near that golf course. He becomes a person of interest when Officer Heath Ropp spots Dalton Barnes walking north on the trail that led from the golf course and the general area where Celia's body was found. So they're looking at this guy. You can just see there's trouble in him. Officer Rob just knows right away there's trouble in this guy.
So how does he proceed, and what does he blurt out in this conversation with this Heath Rop officer? He says that he is, they ask him if he's aware of this woman being killed, and he says, he blurts out, what did Colin do to her? So the police ask, why would he ask that question?
Right, yeah, and because as Colin gets close to it, so they go to the place where they've been living together, and Dalton tells Roe that he and Colin each have a tent in this area. Dalton and Colin Richards are sharing a temporary squatter's encampment, and he just knows something's wrong with Colin because Colin's been talking, well, he's been talking crazy. He's been talking about finding a woman to kill. That's what he wants.
And they know that these tents, where they're living, they have a view, and Dalton mentions this as well, that they both have a view of these golfers all day. That's how close they are to this golf course. So,
right, exactly, yeah.
Now, you talk about him, Colin Richards, and you talked about, you just mentioned that he had just been in prison. But they look, police look, and they find that even though he's homeless, unemployed, he has time to set up a Facebook page where he celebrates drinking coffee and murder, weirdly enough.
Yeah, he does. With a phone, you know, with a smartphone, you can do anything. He has a smartphone, and he sets up a Facebook page, and he celebrates and says, let's do murder. He writes, let's do murder on his homepage.
Mm-hmm. He's also been reported that he's been carrying a big knife, and this is obviously Dalton saying this, and with a serrated edge. So police are very interested in this information. It doesn't sound like, it sounds very credible, doesn't it, to them?
Yes, it does. You know, Dalton shocks Roe, and he says his friend has been talking about an irresistible urge to rape and murder a woman, and he's been carrying a blade that's big enough to cut wood, a blade with a serrated edge. It sounds like the knife that might have been the weapon used to kill Celia. Other officers working the case who have a history with Colin remember that it's not unusual for him to carry a knife. And so they're very interested in him. And as they're working and investigating, all of a sudden, Colin walks right into the investigation. He walks right into the middle of it.
Yeah.
And the officer sees scratches on his face. He's been in a fight. He drops a black backpack on the ground about 10 feet from the tent, and the bag is his because it has his name on it, C. Richards. And he sits down and sticks his left hand into the dirt while the detectives are talking to him.
Wow. So they ask him why he's scratched. They ask him why his hand is bleeding. So he gives some unreasonable excuse for that. And they ask him about his whereabouts. So that questioning does not satisfy them. They take him to the hospital to document his wound, which they believe will help them when the autopsy is performed. What happens in that autopsy? What do they find out?
Well, after the quick interview, they take Colin to the Mary Greeley Medical Center's ER to get the hand damaged, and they had to ask him to pull it out of the dirt. He was obviously hiding his hand in the dirt. And they want to compare Colin's injury to what they've learned from tomorrow's autopsy about the stab wounds and cuts, and what they will learn from the stab wounds and cuts that killed Celia. And they find a similarity. They see that there's a relationship between the hand wound and the wounds that killed Celia.
Right. So now you talk about
the cuts matched. The puncture wounds could have come from any knife with a 4-inch blade, so it's going to be hard to pin down the weapon. But the stab wounds, the slashes, the cuts on Colin's hand and Celia's body do match the ME's find.
Yeah, you write that September 20th, thanks to a garage fire, The Ames police think that they've discovered the knife used to kill Celia, and a long serrated knife with two serrated patterns. So.
Right. Right, exactly. The blaze broke out inside a garage at 317 Washington Avenue, the same small two-bedroom house where police talked to Chris Johnson about Colin Richards 3 days ago, the day they discovered Celia's body on the golf course pond. And now they go into the house as part of their fire investigation, and they meet Christopher Johnson, the homeowner, and they spot a large serrated knife with two serration patterns. The blade is longer than 4 inches. Nothing unusual there, a typical kitchen knife. But remember, the autopsy results showed a knife just like that cut Celia. So now the prime suspect in the homicide investigation was seen at this house 3 days ago, and they find a knife very similar, like a cassette, to one of the knives that cut Celia. It turns out that Colin showered there at the house and changed his clothes at the house, and that knife indeed was part of a set that was in the kitchen. And it is a set that is missing one of the knives.
Yeah. There's a Judge Curry. Bethany Curry is in charge. And what does, as maybe surprising to some people, what does this person, this perpetrator, Colin Richards, want to do? What does he plead to the judge? What was his plea to the judge?
He says, he writes, and this is the way he wrote it on a piece of paper, "I would like to take care of my case. I would like to do whatever it is to move forward, ending the case, PLE, guilty, pleading, obviously, guilty, if that's what it takes. Thank you, and sorry, I do plead guilty." And Curry accepted the note.
Yeah. This story doesn't have, is a little bit different because it doesn't catapult the story into the political arena like Molly's did. But because Celia's a world-class golfer, how does this story get bigger than it would?
Yeah, this becomes an international story, not just a national story, but an international story because her mother is still in Spain, obviously. Her family's still in Spain. The golfers around the world just love Celia. They really are mourning Celia as much, nearly as much anyway, as the family is mourning Celia.
Yeah. So there's the sentencing on August 23rd, 2019 for Colin Richards. First degree in Iowa already carries life without parole sentence. But it was a chance for law enforcement, you say, to show their support for Celia's friends and family, and also to express their grief. But Colin writes a note. What does he have to say to the courts via this note?
Well, there's the note where he wanted to plead guilty. Is that the note you're speaking of?
Well, he just talks, no, it's more the note about the remorse he feels, just not much to the note, but that he said he did feel remorse for stripping society of this person.
Oh, right, right, yes, he did write that, yes. I don't have that note in front of me right now, but yeah, he did write that.
Now, you take us to May 26, 2021, and Christiane's case, you say, is in limbo. Tell us why this was delayed.
Well, it was delayed for about 3 years by worries about pretrial publicity and just the usual slow turning of the wheels of justice, as I wrote. And there also is the complication of the COVID-19 pandemic. Everything is shut down. Everything is locked down. So Christian Rivera is in prison. Well, they're going to decide. The important trial began just 9 days ago, nearly three years after he was arrested because of COVID-19 and the other concerns. But mainly COVID-19.
Right, about defense attorneys Chad and Jennifer Frazee. Uncharacteristically, Christiane takes the stand, and he's wearing headphones, and he has two Spanish language interpreters. What does he claim through these interpreters happened with Molly?
Yeah, well, this is where it got really interesting. He goes on the stand and says that he was taking a shower in his mobile home When he came out of the bathroom, he was stunned to find two men sitting in his living room. Never seen them before. They were both wearing sweaters and masks. And, of course, they had a gun. One of them had a gun. The other one had a knife. One was bigger than him. The other one was about his size. The men force him into his black Chevy Malibu and tell him to start driving straight to Brooklyn, Iowa. And there they start, while they're driving, they're talking about finding someone running, but they want to find a woman jogging. Well, they come upon Molly, as Christian tells the story. And he says, really, these two guys in masks and sweaters, one with a gun, one with a knife, they engineered the whole thing and forced him to stop and fight with Molly and put her in the trunk of his car. And take her then to the cornfield.
Yes, and what he does as well is he throws in some dialogue and says that he heard the men say, "Come on, Jack," which would clearly implicate Molly's boyfriend, Dalton Jack, in this as well.
Right, exactly. So he's trying to, again, you know, say that he didn't do it, but Dalton Jack had a responsibility in this and the guys.
And of course, this is very typical as well. How else did he add a little detail to this? What other threats apparently did these people make to ensure his cooperation?
His girlfriend and their daughter. The men threatened that to hurt Iris and their daughter if he didn't do what they told him to do.
Yeah. Now, May 27th, 2021, you talk about Prosecutor Scott Brown. What happens with this Christian story of kidnap? What does he believe? What does he say?
He says that, Scott Brown says, you know, he disputes the allegations. He said there was...
Yes, there was.
He says the truth is just more straightforward. Now, the prosecutor insists he took her, he committed the crime. What happened? Molly, he says, is no longer on this planet because of the defendant.
Mm-hmm. And she was left there for 5 weeks. So you talk about the appalling crime scene photos that the jury had to endure as well.
Yeah, they were really brutal. I mean, these were the incredible crime scene. One, the photo showed Molly's body under a couple of stalks of corn. You can see her foot sticking out. You can see her clothing on the ground near her body. The body was very decomposed. So yeah, they were really gruesome scene, photos.
And they had him dead to rights with the blood analysis and the DNA in the trunk, didn't they?
Correct, they did. They had him dead to rights, yeah. And the story just, the jury did not buy his story at all, Christian's story about the two guys forcing him to kidnap Molly and then kill her. The jury just did not believe it at all. They deliberated a little more than 7 hours and then found him guilty of first-degree murder.
You talk about the impact on the community with these two end up being sensational murders. Tell us a little bit about that. This is a little place, so there was a significant impact, wasn't there?
Yeah, really, a very significant impact. This is the kind of place, Brooklyn, Iowa, where people, they forgot to lock their doors at night. They didn't worry about it too much. Now they do. And now people in town would say that they're constantly looking over their shoulders because they know Brooklyn, Iowa is no different than any other place, that this can happen there. And again, the same thing on the golf course, Coldwater, and the town where Celia was murdered. You know, this was just a big wake-up call to a couple of small towns and the people who live in those small towns, that they're no safer than somebody in New York, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And in this, you've written about a lot of murders. Why did you feel important to put these two stories, previously published, We'll Find You and Let's Do Murder, together? And, why put these two?
I just thought it was a better story, and they deserved to be together. And the chances of these two women, who had, as I wrote, everything to live for, they both had lives that they were looking forward to. those lives being snuffed out in two small towns in the state of Iowa within months of each other, it just seemed like those stories needed to be together.
Yeah, and you talk as two college students in Iowa with all of their future ahead. You talked about Molly and Dalton planning to go to his brother's wedding in the Dominican Republic. She had just gotten her passport. It was her first. I know it seems cliche, but these people both were some of the nicest people anybody could report. And again, I know that sounds like a cliche, but there wasn't any dirt to find on these people. And it is so sad to see the most undeserving people of this, if not that anyone deserves to be murdered, but just the sheer innocence of these people and the senseless murders.
You know, that's a really strong point, Dan, the innocence of these people. And that's not just Molly and Celia, but their families as well, especially the family of Molly that, I found much more about than I did Celia's. But, just the innocence of these people thrown into this situation. I mean, none of us expects to be on Good Morning America talking about the murder of a loved one.
Yeah. And it's not to be underestimated the intractable situation that they're in, believing that their loved one is still alive, hoping that their loved one is still alive, then their only course is to plead somehow to the goodness of this perpetrator to release her. I can't imagine a more horrifying situation to be in.
Yeah, it is. And, I can't imagine it either. I really can't. And then to have your tragedy put onto a national stage by politicians who want to use that story to their advantage.
Yeah. You did mention that the family, not only the father, but the aunt as well, but other people in the family wanted to make sure, to ensure that this story didn't lose focus on Molly, but instead this was used by political parties at that time to talk about their policy about illegal immigration.
Right.
Plainly.
Right. They both did not want that to happen. And Dan, Rob Chibbitt went national, and he was very, very outspoken in asking people not to make this a political story.
Yes, absolutely. I want to thank you very much, Rod Cackley, for coming on and talking about the Iowa murders, a shocking true crime story. For those that might want to find out more of your work, can you refer them to a page and our website?
Yeah, sure. It's rodcackley.com. And you can always find me there. And also, wherever you buy books, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Apple, Kobe, wherever you find books, you'll find my books. But go to rodcackley.com. That's where I try to keep everything up to date.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Rod. The Iowa Murders, a shocking true crime story. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Rod. You have a great evening. And I know we'll be talking to you again soon. Good night.
Thank you, Dan. Same to you. Have a good night.
Good night.